Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to the Coach and Coordinator Podcast. We are continuing with our series of college leaders, and joining me today is the head football coach at South Dakota School of the Mines, Zach Tinker. Coach Tinker, it's great to have you here.
Keith, thanks for having me on, man.
Coach, before we get into your high-powered offense, one of the best in D2 this past year, I want to talk a little bit about your journey through this profession. So, Coach, tell us, where'd you get your start in coaching, and what made you want to be a coach?
I started at my alma mater, so I played college ball at Western Washington University, which, you know, no longer has football. We were in the NAI and transitioning to D2 program when I was there as a player. And then, you know, I quickly got into high school coaching right after I got done playing. So I coached for a guy named Bob Ames at Meridian High School up in Bellingham, Washington, and had a great experience there. And then that brought me right back to, you know, really started GA-ing at my alma mater for Rob Smith, our head coach there at Western Washington. And, you know, I went from Western Washington. We did four seasons there. We did one season at Southern Oregon, where I kind of, that was my first time really not being just on the line of scrimmage. I was doing special teams and I was doing wide receivers, which was a good change for me. And then I did four seasons as the offensive coordinator at Eastern Oregon University for Tim Camp. And then came to South Dakota Mines when Stacy Collins got the head job. That was back in 2012, and had been in Rapid City ever since. And got the head job at South Dakota Mines in 2016, and now we're going on year four. But yeah, really started coaching probably because as a player, I wasn't a very good player. I knew I was a better coach probably than I was a player. I loved the sport. I really understood it, and you know, I wanted to help players play to their best of their abilities. You know, that was something that I thought was what coaches did. So the X's and O's was never, I mean, I enjoyed the strategy of it, but I just really liked being in a college locker room. And to me, the college football locker room is pretty much the most unique place on the planet.
Coach, as you look back as your growth as a coach, what do you feel are some of the key lessons you've learned, whether that be on your own from making mistakes or things that maybe some of your mentors had taught you?
Yeah, I mean, I think my very first coaching job, one of my former coaches said, hey, come out to this. I'm working at this high school. You should come out and help out here, because I was naive. You know, I thought I was going to graduate college and that, you know, I was going to reach out to, you know, any institution in the country and they'd want me to be their, you know, graduate assistant. It doesn't, as you know, it doesn't quite work that way, right? So I started coaching high school ball, and our very first season, very first team I ever got to be associated with, I was coaching offensive line and defensive line, and we went undefeated and won the state championship. And I thought I was probably one of the really elite football coaches in all of America. I mean, we didn't lose any games, you know? And so I think I just kind of giggle now about how, you know, the things I thought I knew back then. And really that's kind of the cool part of this profession, because you learn every season and every experience, you learn how little you knew back when you thought you knew it all, you know? And since then, you know, you just get humbled every season and learn more about the sport and learn more about how to work with players and how to work with other coaches. And, you know, I think, you know, Rob Smith at Western Washington, he taught me the value of that family, and that was always, as a ball coach, that was your number one priority, was still your family. And I always took that lesson. Tim Camp at Eastern Oregon, I thought his big deal was he was so good at the organization of the program and how to keep the program organized. And Stacy Collins here at South Dakota Mines, I thought Stacy's, I've always thought that his ability to connect in recruiting and really understand how to understand really what a player needs in order to feel right about your school, and how to communicate. I think those are the big lessons I've learned.
Coach, offense has been something that you've been able to help the teams you've coached excel at. First being the offensive coordinator 4 years at the School of the Mines, and now as the head coach. You guys this year were pretty impressive. Number one in the country in Division II in passing. You were number six in scoring at 43.4 points per game. Number one in third down percentage at 55.5% conversion there. 14 in completion at 63.7. And you ran the ball well as well. 204.4 yards per game and number 32 in the country. Looking at that, coach, first of all, I guess, kind of give us a description. What kind of offense do you run? How would you categorize it?
Yeah, we've always called it, our branding of the offense, you know, it used to be the Top Gun offense, right, Keith? And then that was when I first started. And then I realized that shortly after I started going, none of our kids had ever seen Top Gun. So all my references to Maverick and Goose, I mean, they didn't really go very far. So we rebranded the offense, the high octane hard rocker offense. And that's just really, the like you said, the branding of the offense. But when we describe it, I mean, it's evolved quite a bit, I think. You know, what we would say is it's creative simplicity. It's personnel based. It's find your best players, whatever matchups you can find, and make sure the culture of the offense is way more important than, you know, what plays you run. And that's really always been our thing. Our culture is above our players, and then our players are more important than the plays. And if you think about your offensive system and you think, hey, the culture of what we do, how we do things, not what plays we run, is the very most important thing. How we treat each other, how we communicate with each other, how we teach. That's always the most important thing. The next most important thing is your players, because your players, who you have doing what they're good at, what they can do better, how you can develop them. That's always going to be more important than the third thing, which is what plays you end up running, because, we're all running really similar stuff these days.
Yeah.
And so if it was just about what plays we run, we'd all have pretty much the same success, because we're recruiting a lot of the same types of players. And, you know, but it ultimately, I think if you put things into that order, then your organizational structure will be okay. You'll emphasize the value of your players and making sure your best players have a chance to impact the outcome of the game. And then whatever plays you run are just the plays that you tend to run the best based on the teams that you're playing.
Coach, I'm interested in that first part, the culture of your offense. And I want to talk about, in general, the culture of your team. And then we could lead into, I guess, how that becomes part of your offense as well. So when you look at the culture of your team, how have you built that and, I guess, put, you know, you talked about branding, put your signature on it or put your brand on it?
Yeah, we say it's blue collar gold standard. We're going to work with a blue collar mentality. It's an engineering school here in South Dakota Mines. So, guys aren't afraid to get their, you know, some dirt underneath their fingernails and put in the work and do the sweat equity. So we want to act as if we're a blue collar program, which is, you know, put in the work, wake up early, we practice in the morning. We do the things that, you know, we try to do the things that tough people do to see if we can become a tough football team. And then gold standard in terms of the way you hold yourself accountable to getting to a specific standard, as opposed to just, you know, whatever that flavor of the day might be. And then, you know, we still use values, right? You know, our values of trust, you know, that's something that we work on every single day in our program. Accountability, we're, you know, so important. I think that now, you know, one of the things we spend more of our time teaching than anything is how do I, as a leader of the team, communicate with other players on the team. If I know that they're not doing it the right way, how do I do that? And how do I not worry about me hurting their feelings or them hurting my feelings? You know, be perseverant. You know, tough times don't last, tough people do. And then our service component, you know, which we say, you know, we want to serve each other in the program and then become men of service when we talk about what we do off the field. So, you know, those are the values of the program. That's how we build the culture. And what we think we do is the way we keep it, like I said, you know, very simple in terms of what we do. We don't ask our players to do a bunch, but we do expect to do it to the very best of our ability. And if we can do that, we think we'll establish the right type of mindset in the program, because I do find that when we're struggling, you know, going and trying to find new plays to run hasn't ever helped us. What's helped us is reconnecting to the culture, reconnecting to the value system that we have, and that's been what pushes us back, you know, and gets us back on the right track.
When you look at our game, I mean, there is that overriding culture of your program that everybody needs to be aligned with, but then you kind of have all these subsets of your different units, whether that be offense, defense, special teams, your different position groups, et cetera, and they're all a little bit different in the way they are. Just like putting together an organization full of people, everybody's not going to be the same. They just got to get aligned. So when you look at how that culture then kind of builds into your offense, how would you characterize those things in your offense? What things are you saying, this is what we believe in, so this is how we're going to perform and act on the field, act in the classroom with each other, et cetera?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've always kept the same principles of what we do as an offense. Has those things have always been the same. So we always started that we were going to be next play mentality. So that was the first thing of offensive culture. The principles of what we do was we were never going to dwell on things that just happened if they were bad. And we weren't going to, you know, keep patting ourselves on the back from things that we might have done well. I was always a player. I always had a bunch of stress and anxiety when I played because I didn't want to make mistakes. I thought that always held me back. I'm not a great athlete, but I thought I could have been a better player if I would have just been less stressed out about making mistakes. And so that's why we've adopted the next play mentality, which is, hey, you know, we really can't control what just happened. We're going to evaluate it and try to improve, but let's go on and play the next one. So that's the very first thing we teach. And you know, whether it's body language, you know, whether it's how we approach each other when things go well, or how we handle things when they go poorly. You know, the language we use with one another, all those things are important. And then, you know, we always wanted to be flexible. Our idea was never that we were going to necessarily be balanced offensively, but that we could always be flexible, which was if we had to throw it, we needed to be able to throw it. If we had to run it, we needed to be able to run it. And that was a flexibility piece. And then the last one was always this matchup principle that, you know, we certainly think of matchups as, you know, for us, we don't have a lot of offensive plays, so we don't have to spend much time teaching offensive plays. We can spend almost all of our time teaching our players how to attack a defense that they're playing against. And then the other matchup principle, of course, is the playground principle, right, which is let's go recruit, you know, our tails off. Let's go find some players who are hard matchups. And then if we got the best guy on the playground, let's make sure he decides the outcome of the game.
Coach, I'd agree with you 100% in the offensive side of the ball. I mean, we all run the same things, and you can pick up some details here and there that are going to maybe help you be better at a play, but it still comes down to how well you're going to practice it, how well do your guys understand it, can they adjust with it, can they attack with it. And, you know, I think a lot of that, their mentality does come from how you build their culture. So, you said you're simple. You said you don't run a lot. How would you, I guess, break up? What are the concepts that you include in your offense?
Yeah, I think that does change from season to season based on who your best players are. I would say the number one thing that we do, if we were talking about a system, if you were saying, hey, now, Keith, we're just talking X's and O's, then you would say the first thing that we do is we identify the core concepts that we want to teach the offensive line, and then basically add the window dressing from there. So what we try to do is limit the number of concepts that the offensive line has to learn. So, you know, instead of teaching, you know, 8 or 9 specific different run plays, you know, we really try to just focus on, hey, what are the zone plays that we like? And then we try to match our zone terminology and components as best we can, whether we're running a tighter zone or a wider zone. And then, okay, how are we teaching gap concepts? Okay, let's get that done. And then really just breaking into from there, you know, how are we going to protect the passer and having our just several, you know, a few ways that we're doing that. And then whenever we're looking at, okay, if we want to do something a little bit different to attack a defense, it is almost, I can't think of a time when we've added new concepts to the offensive line during the course of the season. That's how much I think it's important, because my first job was as an O-line coach, as my first full-time job, and we ran a lot of stuff. And so you kind of had to have this menu of everything you knew how to block against every front and stunt. And I was thought, and this is just not very efficient for us. I mean, this is hard. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's always been my mindset. And then let your skill players, and let like formations and maybe some pre-snap movement, let that stuff be the differentiator, and let the offensive line learn how to do a few things pretty well. And I think that's why when you see us, we typically are pretty good at running and passing the ball, just because we get a lot of practice reps of just the handful of things that we teach our guys to do.
Looking at the passing side of the ball, and you guys were number one in the country in Division II passing the ball, 332.4 yards per game. What makes up, I guess, the core? I mean, there's going to be a lot of variations of things or tags here and there, but what makes up the core of what you teach your guys in the passing game?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, that's a hard one to always articulate, right? Because every season it's a little bit different based on how good certain receivers are, how good your quarterback is, how well your backs are catching the ball out of the backfield. When we think about the principles of the passing game, our very first one is the quarterback is going to throw the ball on time. And so for us, you know, just that, I always tried to design it where you wouldn't be able to block the other guys for very long. And so how would you design your pass game if you couldn't block them for very long? Not that we're not good on the offensive line. I think we are. We've gotten a lot better. But, I've always thought that the thing that differentiates the really, really good teams from the average teams is usually that defensive line play, right? And so, I want to be able to play against the really good teams we saw and still be able to have an offense. So throwing the ball fast is really important to us, or throwing the ball on time. And then from there, it's really, we try to do some things with, we're not doing nearly as much progression pass game. So we used to be like a bunch of heavy progression stuff, right? Almost that, what you would refer to as air raid, where you're going to work from my first option to my second to my third to my check down to my move plays. We're probably doing some of that still, but I think we're doing a little bit more, try to pick on a defender and get the ball out of our hands on a route that we know, we can get a completion on. So I don't know if that's a great answer to your question. I would just say that the principles are always get the ball out on time, mm-hmm. and then everything else is built on. And I always thought that progression stuff was awesome, because technically you're always right that there's always going to be a gap or a spot available, but that's hard to do when you have people, tackling you.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with you 100% that, you do want to build your passing game, to get the ball out quick. I mean, I know in coordinating our offense, I was really looking at 2.6 is the longest time I wanted to be in the pocket with the ball. Now I might move and create more time, but ideally, we're getting the ball out. Best case scenario, it's out in like a 1.8 to a 2.0 seconds. And we did a lot of calibrating with that. How much do you guys look at that and try to figure out, calibrate how those things fit together?
Yes, that's an awesome question. I'm not I don't do a lot of like the stopwatch stuff behind the cues. I would say one thing that we do, and I think you're right on. I mean, I think that what you just said in terms of, time is probably about right. What we try to do, and I don't know if you guys or you hear a lot of people doing this, one thing we do all the time is try to keep plays alive when we're doing drills that aren't maybe like, for example, when we do a pass 7-on-7 or a skelly type drill in our program, we don't blow the whistle very often. So what we try to do is we try to start teaching that clock to the quarterback. So, we have probably more scramble plays where we're trying to keep plays alive in 7-on-7 than any place I've been, because, when you sit there and pat the ball, I just never thought that was real realistic. Right. Mm-hmm. So we try to tell our feet, if we are doing something in the progression game and we've, we've hit a three-step drop because we're all gone, and then we gather one time. If the ball's not out, we should be moving. And I think that sort of teaches the game a little bit better for our guys. So that's one thing we do to try to speed our clock up. And I think that, you know, as long as you keep doing those things where you emphasize how important it is. And then the other thing we do, you know, specifically when we don't have a star quarterback, we just happen to have a star quarterback this past season. But in years when we're not at that point, you know, most of the season, we don't necessarily put those quarterbacks in a different color jersey. We let them play because I don't think there's anything more valuable than teaching a quarterback how to play than there is the threat of physical harm if they don't throw the ball on time, you know.
Yeah, I've heard some coaches on this podcast talk about that, and I think, you know, to me, it certainly makes me uneasy to think about, you know, getting that guy hit in practice, but at the same time, if he doesn't have some kind of pressure, whether you somehow manufacture that for him in the pocket, you know, for me, it honestly was constantly putting the stopwatch on him and give him that feedback, because our head coach wasn't going to let that guy be hit.
Oh, sure.
But doing that, though, I think gets them more in the game day feel. I mean, it changes real quick when you don't have that yellow jersey on and now everybody's around you rather than that, you know, cushion of protection that you usually have.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, the other thing, especially when you're doing – it's so hard. You know how it is. I mean, if you go – let's say you're coming into a season and you're going to play a first-year starter, right, or someone who's maybe he's played for you, but he's not really been the guy before, and you're going into that game one, if some of the things you'll see, like, for example, when he does scramble, he doesn't know what to do at the end of a run because he hasn't had to be at the end of a run in a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So those types of things I think are really important to get that out of the way. So this will be an interesting spring practice for us because we have several, we just graduated, you know, probably the best player that ever played here at quarterback in Jake Sullivan. And he was incredible. And so now these other guys, it'll be really good for them. They've been live most of their career in practice, but now, you know, there'll be some real chances to show themselves. And I also think I was a defensive lineman, as a former D lineman and from an overall program perspective, I think it's harder than people think to actually sack the quarterback. Mm-hmm. And I think that practice of how to actually get that dude on the ground, because I know it, I think we're seeing it more and more, is I think quarterbacks are more and more athletic. We're going back to best player on your team is playing quarterback. And I think if you look at the guys who've been dominating college football recently, a lot of them are guys who maybe you get to the quarterback, and that doesn't, just because you get there doesn't mean he's on the ground. And so I think it's important for training your team too.
Yeah, I've never thought about it from that perspective, but you're right. Like you see that all the time now, where guys are almost there and they just don't make the play. And yeah, I wonder how much is the correlation of they actually don't get to practice those kinds of things. You know, I mean, it's easy to go back and sack one of those stand-up dummies, or you know, the little thing with the arm held up with the ball Velcro to it. I mean, those things don't move. But that dude who knows how to move in the pocket,
mobility.
Yeah, that dude who knows how to move in the pocket is a different story.
100%, 100%. Because and I think that, you know, all that teaching. I mean, I think we teach that a lot, right? We teach, and you watch like the best guys who've ever done it, you know, and you watch how they can. Even, you know, whether it's Manning or Brady, guys who aren't super athletic, but they can make an 18-inch to 24-inch adjustment of where their feet are in the pocket that totally changes the angle that the defense needs to attack them at. I mean, that's pretty impressive stuff. And the way they move and they suddenly create space for themselves, I think that's just really important. And, you know, we try to teach that with our cues, right? How to move efficiently, you know, how to move as little as possible, but create new windows. I mean, that's just very important. And I just think it's something that, you know, again, when you're under real duress and you could get hit, it your urgency level and then your commitment to protecting yourself is a little higher.
Absolutely. In thinking of protection, Coach, what's your quarterback's involvement in those protection calls and in the way the slide might go or who's man, who's zone, et cetera? Do you guys give him any role in that, or is he able to sit there and understand the calls and understand what the movement's going to be, or he's not concerned with it at all?
No, I think that's a great question. I mean, couple things. I think I've done it both ways, right? So we used to give the quarterback the protection. So we would, in essence, give him a protection and then give him a route concept, you know, to go with that protection, right? And that's fine. Then I had a quarterback one time who I was giving him those protections and he was just giving he was just reciting what I gave him. He really had no concept of what was happening, right? You know, so, you know, I'm not sure that we were arming him with any information. But I think that as we've gone along, the best for us is if we have parameters per concept. So let's say we have a four verticals concept. And so if we're running four verticals, we have what we call a default protection that goes with four verticals. So we don't give the quarterback that protection when we call four verticals. He just knows, hey, it's four verticals, and so I'm going to use one of my default protections. And then on a week-to-week basis, you may say to him, hey, when we go to four verticals on this week, let's switch the protection because all their pressures are coming from the field when we're in this look. So let's always put the man side of the boundary and slide to the field, right? Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. You may make that adjustment and change his default protection. Then he knows why. Okay, that's why we would do that. And then we also feel like we have some flexibility where, let's say we're running four verticals in a game and we really want to emphasize that we want to use our back as a hot receiver. Then I may give him just a little word or a little signal so that he understands, oh, he called four verticals, but he really wants me to work my back, and then he can use his protection that way. So it's a little bit of a combination of all those things, but I think the quarterback knowing how the protections work is really phase A for understanding how do I distribute the football. And I think it's been huge for us that I don't give them the protections anymore. They, in essence, memorize the protections and which protections go with which concepts. And that's been pretty effective for us.
Yeah, I kind of made that journey into really getting the quarterback to understand and be married to the protections. In my first year as a quarterback's coach at BW, I was given the task of getting our quarterback to stop losing yards when he scrambled. And the head coach had all these examples of the quarterback. I mean, he's really athletic kid, of him going back and scrambling and turning the other way and going. I'm like, okay. So we did start to get him married up to the protection and understand the protection and the way we would run it. And this became actually a whole evolution over the years. But the way we would run the protection at the time is we had a natural B-gap escape. So we were manning up a tackle and then we were sliding essentially to the three technique, you know, seeing a lot of two-man front. So the natural place to leave was the B-gap. And his understanding of that, you know, he would net about 70 yards a game just on B-gap escapes. Instead of going backwards, he was leaving the pocket in that. Essentially, we gave him an exit route, like, you are going to start here. So things start to break down. Your first thought is to head to the B-gap, away from where the slide was called. And then that started an evolution into, all right, well, how's he going to understand the slide? So we found, like, okay, he's actually standing up there listening to where the center's making his calls, and then he's kind of doing things based on that. And then we got into a mic ID thing, and so we just said, hey, you'll be in charge of the protection too, and now you'll make the call. The center will hear it. You're in a better spot to see things overall anyway, and So we gave that responsibility to the quarterback and really got into then the indicators, right? And understanding defensive indicators, who's going to show you where the pressure is going to come from. And a lot of times it was, you know, a lot of times we found it to be the boundary safety. It would vary sometimes, but then he would start to use the cadence to identify those indicators, make his calls, adjust things. And just in doing that, having that understanding, giving him those tools, and this was a different quarterback as we progressed to that. I mean, we drastically cut down on the amount of hits that quarterback was taking and amount of sacks. And then we would get, when plays break down, we would get some nice escapes because he knew where to leave and knew what kind of routes we had, you know, taking guys away from that area as well. So he could look, as he's going, he could still attack as we told him always. Keep yourself as a threat as a passer. Don't tuck that thing right away. But once you cross the line, then you can put it away. So you have those guys hanging back. You know the protection. You have a chance actually to turn it into a nice run.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you're right on. I mean, I think that, you know, what you're trying to do with those, especially, you know, our Jake was a great athlete. He is a great athlete. But, you know, there are times when is kind of doing the Fran Tarkenton back there, and you're thinking, all right, man, some things could happen here. So I think, you know, what you're talking about, parameters, is just, again, I think what happens is we get into so many different pass concepts that we want to run that's when I think we start to struggle with the fundamentals of what you just said, which is, all right, where are my escape? We call them exit strategies. Yep. What's the exit strategy for this play, right? And so, I think the number one mistake we make, and I've done it before, is we go into a game with 19 different pass concepts that we could get to. He's not really going to have a great feel for the exit strategy for 19 different pass concepts.
No.
And the separate defenses he may see to each of those concepts. And so that's why we really, you know, I always get a little embarrassed when people ask me to, you know, tell me about your pass plays. And I show them our, you know, five pass plays I feel a little inadequate, but you know, we're able to do some good stuff with it. But I think it's cause it's pretty simple for us. And then maybe use a little bit of creativity on how you get to them, and you should be okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've found over time that the less we put into the game plan, the better we were, and a lot of it too was, you know, sometimes you overplan and you know you want to have all the answers, all the what ifs, but then you go into the game and you call a few things over and over again, and you might give it different looks, but you realize, okay, this is what we're doing. I mean, it's probably no secret if you watched the film of any of the teams I coached, we were going to call four verts a lot, and we were pretty good at it. And I mean, I can remember we just went down with 2 minutes in the game. This was against Mount Union. They were national champs that year. I mean, they were really good. And we got pinned back inside like the 15 on the kickoff, and we need a touchdown. And I mean, we go all the way down the field. I just called four verts the whole way down. And we ended up, is there a little bit of a controversial call at the end? I don't want to go into that right now. still a hard one to remember.
I can tell you, you've let that go.
But the point is, like, I mean, we just did it, and our guys executed because that's what they knew how to do. I mean, the point being, the game was on the line. It was crunch time. What are we going to go to? And I think too many times we get off of that as our answer. Instead of finding ways to execute within that better, we look for something different for an answer.
Yeah, I think you said it right on. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the same thing for us. You know, when you talk 2 minute, that's part of our DNA. And 2 minute is, personally, I don't call plays during the 2 minute because I think there's only so many plays I'm going to call anyways. So the value of the time that I save getting a play from me to the quarterback, there's only a couple things he's going to call anyways. So as long as he calls one of those few things we run, That could save us 5 or 6 seconds during the 2 minute drill, and just let him run it because it really does fit what we already know how to do.
Yeah, I love that idea. That's something we had progressed to as well. And you know, I always felt like, hey, here's the 3 or 4 plays we're going to run. I think we had like maybe a draw in and a short yardage play as well. But, you know, the guy would go out there, he'd call his 3 passes, he'd get everybody aligned, let him orchestrate it. He's the one who's got to execute it anyway, right? The game's on the line, put it in his hands. I've always felt that way.
Yeah, 100%.
Coach, looking at the third down package, and again, I'm sure a lot of this just carries over to your regular passing game. You guys led the country this year, converting 55.5% of your attempts. So you're staying on the field, moving the ball down the field. What would you point to, I guess, as one of the key things you're doing, or could you share, I guess, one of your favorite third down conversion plays?
Yeah, I think, you know, first, we were special at quarterback. So I want to be as clear as I can.
That always
helps. I don't think it was the plays we were calling. Yeah, I mean, he's a special player. And we also had a couple of really nice, I mean, we had good talent on offense. We had good players. So that's the first thing, right? A couple things that we do that we think is important in money downs in terms of how we put it all together. One is we practice more often than not. We practice what we would refer to as a spot the ball style of practice. I think third downs, money downs, and then red zone offense, defense, oftentimes we used to practice those as a separate period. So, for example, we would say, hey, we're going to do a third down period, and we're going to do a 3rd and 10, and then a 3rd and 8, and then a 3rd and 6, right? And we've all been a part of that. I don't think that's bad to emphasize third down, but I believe that also money down plays or money down critical situation football, there's a context for how you got to third down that plays into what you're going to do on third down. So you might have got to 3rd and 10 by just missing on a first down shot play that you really, really liked. And you took a shot and you just barely missed it, and it's a good miss, right? And then on 2nd and 10, you might have called something a little bit simple, and a defensive lineman might have got a hand on the ball. That's a different type of getting the 3rd and 10 to me than on first down, our quarterback gets whacked as he's throwing the ball, and it's almost a fumble, but they call it incomplete. And then on 2nd and 10, we try to get a little something going in the run game, and we just get stoned at the line of scrimmage. So those 2 3rd and 10s aren't equal. They're different. They have a different context. There's different momentum. There's different emotion. And so I really think about that stuff, and I think that the context of how you get to a third down is just as important as the third down itself. And then the other thing we do is we go for it probably on fourth down more than any team in the country. So I think that our players have less anxiety about third down because they know in the back of their head, well, if you don't really get it here, he'll probably let us go for it on fourth down anyways. Those are a couple of the things that I think help. And then, you know, what we do probably more than we've done in the past is we do, even though we're a tempo offense, we will kind of go to our what we would say is our known concepts that we like on third down. And then the quarterback has some freedom at the line of scrimmage to get his best player on something a little bit different than what maybe was called. And I found that when quarterbacks have the authority to maybe change, not the whole play, but maybe change one route, that they're more likely to throw to that route and they're more invested in the completion because they're the one who called it. I know that's, sounds pretty like psychoanalytical, but those are the experiences we've had.
In your offense, the one thing we haven't discussed, and we've discussed quite a bit here, but the RPO, how much does the RPO play a part in your offense?
This is like the million-dollar question, right? It's like I would tell you that everyone that plays against us, I believe they think we're running RPOs. I don't consider them to be RPOs. You know, when I think about RPOs, I don't know how you define RPOs. I define an RPO as it's I'm making a post snap, either a second level or third level defender. I'm reading either a second level or third level defender. And I'm reading him, and I'm going to either give the ball, keep the ball, or throw the ball based on what that second or third level defender does. That's what I think an RPO is. Meanwhile, my offensive line is running the run play, right? We don't do that many of those. We have some, but that's not the core of it. We do far more what I would call gift throws, where it's a pre-snap decision based on they're giving me a certain amount of space. I see space. I'm going to throw the ball to the space that's already there. And so I'm not doing as many key reads of a second and third level defender. We kind of do it that way. I don't know that I'm a good enough coach to teach him all the second and third level defender reads. We did more RPOs in the past. We seemed to be the only team in the country that was consistently getting called for illegal man downfield. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of done with this, you know? So I think some of what we run some what we would call, you know, pop passes or run action passes that I think those look like they're RPOs.
Yeah.
But they're more pass plays. Does that make sense? Are you hearing similar things out there or what? It seems like more people are doing second and third level defender reads, but I even like watching the championship game, watching, and really the semifinal game, some of that stuff with Tua, sometimes it looks like it's a real RPO and sometimes it looks like it might be an actual pop pass where they're going to throw the ball to the window that's there. So,
yeah, I know there were a couple plays where the announcers were calling them RPOs and I thought, how in the world could he be reading that guy over there when he was looking the other way? I mean, it had to be a play action pass. There's just no way, or he was somehow keying a rotation based on another safety somewhere. I mean, I've not heard of anybody doing that, reading somebody away to determine if there's going to be someone there or not. So I do think quite a bit, you know, when we're just watching a game, quite a bit of what might be play action gets confused with some of the RPO. But yeah, I would consider that the same way. I mean, I consider not the gift throws, but those throws that you are reading that second or third level defender. And you know, I had a coach on the other day. He described, you know, what they do with the third level more as a pass run option. In other words, he's not going to call those third level plays where they're reading somebody unless he has some pretty good confidence that they're going to throw the ball. And then he uses the run part. Really, his quarterback understands that's kind of our out. If it doesn't look great, then he'll give it. So it's kind of the opposite the run pass option. I always thought of it that way too. I never thought of it calling it a PRO, but that's what he referred to it as.
No, and I think that stuff makes a lot of sense. I mean, I would tell you that when we prioritize how we teach the run game, and I bless every O-line coach that's ever worked for us, but and it drives them nuts, but we actually teach how to throw the ball on all our run plays before we teach how to do the exchanges. Cause we're trying to get the ball to the spaces that are there. And I think, and I don't know if that makes it so we're more productive in the gift game, but I would just say that that's the first thing we teach the quarterbacks is how to prioritize where the ball would go in the pass game first. We don't necessarily count the box numbers. We look, it's more space or grass type concept, but I think that's one of the things that's made us, you know, where we throw for a pretty decently high percentage overall in the pass game, and then our gift game is pretty productive because maybe the priority we place on it.
Absolutely. Coach, we spent a lot of time here talking offense. We did talk about your culture. When you look at the things you're doing now, as the guy running the program, the head football coach, certainly you guys excel on offense, but in the whole big picture, what would you point to as one thing that gives your team as a whole the winning edge?
That's great. You know, I think for us, it's it's really, we just go through what we call the formula of how to win games, and we really try to emphasize that of, you know, what we think the winning formula is. We've always believed that the winning formula starts with play a physical brand of football, and yeah, it's something we work on tirelessly. You know, we're a program where it seems like we end up playing a lot of young players early in their time here, so sometimes it's hard to get your team as physical as you want them to be, but we're always trying to do the things necessary, get as strong as we possibly can in the weight room, so that we can play a physical style of football where, you know, we talk about owning the football, you know, the true correlation between winning games based on turnover margin. We think that's, you know, mission critical to our success. We're huge in what we call the SWAT games, special teams, where we really want to not just play those plays, but try to create an advantage. So, for example, you know, we blocked 5 kicks this season. 2 of them we were able to score touchdowns off of. We do think that, hey, if we can dominate in that area, then we really only need to win one other phase of the game, right? And then, you know, when we talk about critical situation football, the things we talked about, third downs, our red zone, and our fourth quarter component. And then the thing I think that we think is our winning edge is, to me, the hardest thing now in a college football program is to how to get your team's juice level right for all the things you're asking them to do. Because we do expect a lot of our players, and, you know, we're so huge on the proper energy level. And we really think, like, usually the more excited team wins, you know, the juicier team wins. And so we really practice, you know, how to have juice when we don't want to have juice. What do we do as coaches to make sure our juice level is right so that our players can go and play with that enthusiasm and excitement? Hey, sometimes you just got to fake it till you make it. It's just pretend like you're enthusiastic until you become enthusiastic. Those things are important to us just in terms of how we establish our style of play. So I think what we do in terms of really emphasizing our juice level, I just want to be, we go 11 straight, no bye week. I want us to be energetic and enthusiastic in each of those 11 tries. And I don't necessarily need us over the top in any one of those games. You just want to try to get that level to the same as long as you can. Even if you look at the best teams out there, they all have games where they lack a little juice, right? Mm-hmm. And you've seen it all over the country. And our goal is just to do whatever we can to be the best version of us that we can be on a regular basis, you know, as consistently as we can. And I think it's by being really simple, by, you know, what we do ask of our guys is more energy and enthusiasm than it is memorizing a bunch of different plays to run.
Coach, great stuff there from you. I appreciate all the time you took with us today. For our listeners out there, how can they connect with you?
Yeah, you know, hit us up on the Twitter. It's at Coach Tink, HC. And hit us up over there and anytime, you know. I think you know, Rapid City, South Dakota is a pretty unique place. You come out and you see Mount Rushmore, you do the Badlands, you go up to Deadwood and lose some money if you want to up there in the old Western town. And then you come watch us practice. You know, you got to wake up early, but I'll buy you a Starbucks to get you out there. And you know, we're pretty much an open book for people out there because, you know, really the theme that we just talked about, which is I don't think what we do is really all that great. We do think that how we do it is what our winning edge is. So love to see anybody who wants to come out to Rapid City and make a vacation of it.
Coach, I appreciate your time. It was great talking with you again, and good luck to you and your team in 2019.
You're the man. Rock on.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.